like an animal, talks like an animal, must be an animal. Come hear the animal, talking animal, talking animal. Talks like an animal, must be an animal. Come hear the animals, talking animals, talking animals.
Good morning and happy new year. This is Talking Animals. I'm Duncan Strauss, and my guest today is Dr. Ann Weaver, an animal behaviorist who for more than a dozen years has conducted a long-term study of free-ranging bottlenose dolphins off the coast of St. Petersburg, Florida. Weaver has just published her first book about dolphins, Secrets Behind the Dolphin Smile, 25 Amazing Things Dolphins Do, which indeed provides some often striking tales about the cetaceans she's been studying, including a female kidnapping another's calf and a male playing dead as a highly unusual courting strategy, among many others. She knows these dolphins well, including their history and families, having closely observed them 2 to 3 times a week for all those years. We'll hear how the study began, what findings it's yielded thus far, a sampling of the more notable stories featured in the book, and more when I speak with Dr. Ann Weaver in a moment here on Talking Animals. And that interview will be streaming on Facebook Live via my personal page. Just go to Duncan Strauss if you're anywhere near Facebook, and you should be able to see what we're doing at this very moment. Later in the show, I'll speak with Trevor Chin of Florida Voices for Animals, which has organized a demonstration for Saturday when Showman Circus will be performing. Meanwhile, let's get to Dr. Weaver with a reminder that I invite you to join the conversation by calling 813-239-9663, emailing dj@wmnf.org, or texting 813-433-0885. This is Dr. Ann Weaver on Talking Animals. Good morning, Dr. Weaver.
Good morning, Duncan.
Thanks for joining us on Talking Animals. I know it was a harrowing drive over in this kind of crazy weather we're having. And last time we spoke, a little over a couple years ago, it was by phone. So I'm happy to have you in person, in studio, eye contact, actually. Holy smokes. We don't get it enough here on Talking Animals. So thank you so much. So I'm eager, of course, to get to the matter at hand, which is dolphins and your new book about them. But first, by way of prelude and to establish some context, let's trace at least part of the career path that led you to studying these bottlenecks. Those dolphins. In the final pages of the new book, as part of the end credits, you provide a list of animals you have worked with directly or studied, and it's quite a staggering list in terms of the sheer quantity of species. So talk a little bit about the academic pursuits, and I guess professional pursuits, that offered the opportunity to cross paths with so many animals.
I have made it my business since I was 18 to work with as many animals as I possibly could. So if there was a job that had animals, I took it.
So you were an animal nut from childhood forward, and it's like, hey, how do I do more of this, get more of this with animals?
I had an epiphany in my freshman year of college where I discovered the science of animal behavior.
And that's what drove this interest, kind of?
It compelled me. I didn't have a lot of choice. Animals are fascinating to me. So if there was an animal involved in a job, I would take the job. So that led me to a number of different venues, including the Department of Agriculture, the San Diego Zoo, and a number of other organizations in which animals are housed, including research institutions.
So just in terms of a little quick hit, so what kind of work were you doing for the Department of Agriculture? And I'm sure what would likely contrast, what kind of work were you doing at the San Diego Zoo?
Well, for example, with the Department of Agriculture, that part of the government oversees animal facilities. So this was in the Chicagoland area, and that particular USDA office had jurisdiction over any facility in northern Illinois that had animals, including Lincoln Park Zoo, O'Hare Airport. Mm. So I was an animal and plant health inspection agent, and we would go and make sure people were maintaining the criteria associated with having a permit to have the animal.
Wow. And I don't know what it was like when you were doing that, but it certainly seems like in many of the ensuing years, there aren't enough of those people doing that job, or maybe not enough doing it as strictly as some organizations would like? Was that your experience, that maybe just the sheer volume of facilities to inspect, maybe that was part of it, and people, maybe there was an underemployment issue relative to those, to the demands of that job? But you certainly have heard over the years that there just haven't been enough people doing those kind of inspections, and or some would say doing them diligently enough.
I would say there's not enough people doing those kind of inspections because animal facilities are everywhere. And most of us don't realize how prominent they are until you get into that line of work.
Yeah. If you could just step just a little closer, then we'll hear you crisp and clear, and that's great. Okay, so it sounds like any job that got you with animals, especially animal behavior, sign me up was basically your motto.
Yeah. Absolutely.
Now, I also think, and maybe we can trace this path a little further, at some point that led to, or at least a byproduct of that long-time passion, was academia, right? So it's been my experience generally and over the years of doing the show that when someone animal-oriented enters the hallowed halls of academia, they tend to stay put, find it a good base for researching and publishing alongside the teaching duties. Now, if I'm not mistaken, you spent a number of years in that world, but then left. Did you find you just had enough, or just wasn't really kind of allowing you to do enough of the focus on behavior, which, again, as we know, has driven you since you were a teenager? What led to exiting?
It's a practical consideration. I was always interested in higher education, so I would go get one of those degrees, and then I'd go back to work for the wild and in the real world. Then I'd go back to academia, get another degree, go back to the real world, get a job, go back and get a degree again, and I've done that my whole life.
But wasn't there a period where you would go to academia and then be there like as a professor, or be there actually staying put on campus?
Yes, I was a professor and dean for several years after I finished my postdoc, and had an opportunity to work on this particular dolphin project. That's what was very important about that combination.
I see. But once you got started with the project, you thought, hey, enough with the students and the papers and the publisher parish and all the other stuff. I just want to focus on my dolphins. Is that?
I would love to just focus on the dolphins.
Yeah.
But we all have to be practical. So you do the best you can to maintain your passion while you make sure that you can pay your bills.
Gotcha. This is Talking Animals. I'm Duncan Strauss. If you just tuned in, my guest is Dr. Ann Weaver, an animal behaviorist who's been conducting a long-term study of bottlenose dolphins off the coast of St. Petersburg, Florida. She's published a new book, Secrets Behind the Dolphin Smile, 25 Amazing Things Dolphins Do. If you'd like to ask Dr. Weaver a question or offer a comment, please call 813-239-9663, email dj@wmnf.org, or text 813-433-0885. Also, if you're just joining us and you probably didn't hear that the interview is also streaming live, it's on Facebook Live via my personal page. Just look for Duncan Strauss, and there we will be. So I guess, given the thing you've established of behavior, animals, that's what I'll do. That's the job. The next job is whatever the next job that allows me to do that. So why dolphins? Because it seems like if I follow the story, once you hit dolphins, it's like, hey, I'm not moving on to any other job or any other animal. I'm sticking with dolphins.
The opportunity to study dolphins came to me, and it's a very difficult row to hoe. There are a number of reasons for that, but in order to study wild dolphins, you have to have access to them. That in and of itself is very difficult and very expensive. And in terms of their behavior, Duncan, it's very difficult to see their behavior because, as everyone knows, most of what they do happens underwater and out of sight. So the first several times dolphins came into my life, and invited me to study them, I took them up on their offer, but it is extremely difficult. And oftentimes there were easier venues for me that were just as interesting. For example, primates. So I've spent a lot of time studying apes and monkeys, specifically pygmy chimps and capuchin monkeys, but a variety. But I kept getting called back. And in some respects, it's a curiosity to me. I'm certainly grateful for it. But the opportunity to study free-ranging bottlenose dolphins kept coming back into my life. And the fifth time, I said, I get it. I'll stay.
So tell me about how it got to five times. So you would start a study and then, or start working on something dolphin-related, and then another opportunity or some other project came up and that would divert you for a time, or...
Yeah, very much so. So for the first time that I had the opportunity to work with free-ranging bottlenose dolphins was in Southern California, and I did my master's on it. So when your master's is complete, you generally move to something else, but I was fortunate enough right after finishing my master's to get a job at the world-famous San Diego Zoo. So you're going to take that if you're interested in animals. And then an opportunity came for me to study dolphins again in Baja, Mexico. So I went and worked as a marine mammal professor with students who came and spent a semester abroad in Mexico, and we studied dolphins down there. Then I went to get my PhD. So that switched me back over to primates.
So the PhD was actually in primates while the master's was in dolphin behavior.
That's right. The benefit of studying primates when you're interested in behavior is that they teach you to see detail in fast action. Now, in the primate studies that I have done, I'm interested in social development, so I watched the kids grow up. And if you watch monkey kids, or if you watch ape kids, you have to be quick. It's like writing everything down that's going on at a playground of human children. You've got to be quick. And that kind of rehearsal, if you will, honed my eye to be able to study dolphins the way I can now. And I think that if I hadn't had those years of learning how to look at detailed behavior at speed and documenting it, it would be even more difficult to do what I do than it is now.
So upon that fifth time where dolphins were beckoning you and finally said, okay, I'm listening now, I must focus and stick with the dolphins, was there a specific premise or idea for that study that you said, okay, this is also what maybe has drawn me back, this is what I'm going to do, and this is how I'm going to pursue that study?
Yes, absolutely. I am very much aware of environmental degradation and the impact of humans on natural animal populations. Always have been. Worked for the EPA, and that helped hone my eye for that. Mm. So when I moved to Florida, I found out that there was going to be a major coastal construction project in a vital corridor of water between the Gulf of Mexico and the Intracoastal Waterway. Because I had had experience studying free-ranging dolphins in other parts of the world, I fired off an application to NOAA, the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration, who oversees this kind of research, and said, I will do a before, during, and after study around this coastal construction. They were going to build a new bridge over this water corridor. And they recognized the opportunity. They sent me the permit, and the study started shortly thereafter.
So that was in what year?
That was in 2005.
Okay. So I don't know how long that construction project took, but now that we're 12 years or so in, I would think at least that just by the nature of studies and progress and completing a complicated construction project, has the study evolved or changed in some ways over that 12 years?
The study has not evolved. What you do when you do a study of animal behaviors, you develop a way to take your data. You work on that hard because you can't change it once it's in place, because otherwise your data are inconsistent. So you establish, it's called a sampling protocol. So the way we conduct the study has not changed over time, but it's been in three phases. So we were able to get data on the dolphins before construction started on the bridge replacement project, the 5 years during which the bridge was being replaced, and then subsequent to that. What makes that pertinent to a study of free-ranging animals is that researchers rarely have the opportunity to get data before mankind or humanity has potentially made a change to them. So the fact that you have baseline data is huge. Then you can compare, here's what was real. Mm-hmm. Okay, now that this is happening, we're blowing up the bridge, we've got lights everywhere, we've got barges parked in, we're pounding, we've increased the noise levels. Now what are the dolphins doing? And then once construction stopped, then what are the dolphins?
No, I see as you lay that out how that's probably a singular opportunity, really.
They don't come along as often as we would like.
And when we say free ranging, I assume do we just mean wild or?
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
The wild dolphins at sea.
Okay. Yeah. Just wanted to make sure. All right. Well, we've had one caller that's been holding. Let's obviously have many more questions myself, but let's get a caller involved. Hi, you're on Talking Animals with Dr. Weaver.
Yes. Thank you so much. Dr. Weaver is one of my heroes. As you know, Dr. Weaver, dolphins are pretty big around here on the Gulf Coast, and we have the famous victim dolphin, Winter, who is living with her prosthetic tail at the Clearwater Marine Aquarium. And as someone born and raised in Pinellas, I've been shocked over the years to see the many harms that humans do to dolphins, manatees, and really the entire ocean systems with all of their different motorized recreational vehicles, such as especially jet skis, the way developers are, the Navy using sonar. And I'd just like you to comment briefly, since the Clearwater Marine Aquarium refuses to even condemn crab trapping, which is what, you know, hurt Winter. Can you just outline the many threats, both physical and political, that are facing dolphins and other sea mammals? Because I'll tell you this, in the 55 years I've been alive in Pinellas, my dolphin sightings and manatee sightings are way down, and sometimes you can go almost an entire season and only see a couple when there used to be huge numbers, and they're crashing. So who is threatening them, and what can we do about it?
Thank you for your question. Dr. Weaver?
Thank you for calling. There's a number of reasons why we might say that the dolphin population numbers and other marine mammals are declining. Water quality is part of it. The acoustic environment, the increase of vessels on the waterways is going to change the acoustic environment by increasing sound. And we know that this can stress dolphins. We know it can take a lot more energy for them to maintain their groups. And the fact that there are little restrictions on the number of vessels on the water, that is seems to me fundamental to it. And then finally, some of the harvesting that's gone on in the past has compromised the fish populations, certainly could be at issue as well.
Okay, thank you. The caller dropped off after he asked the question. So I guess kind of almost dovetailing with that and what we were talking about before the caller joined us, I'm sure this is a long answer to do it fully, but how would you characterize in some sort of summary, I guess, what you have found in those three phases that mark the study that you are still conducting now?
What we found in the before, during, and after study, we're still conducting, is that there was a statistically significant decline in the resident female dolphins over the course of construction. I characterized it as a slow leak as opposed to an abrupt exodus, and suggested that we can discourage animals from using their habitual areas if we change the environment long and hard enough. And in some long-lived animals, it doesn't appear that initially they're affected, but we can eventually persuade them to change their habits. So the after part of our study has to do with monitoring the local population to see if their numbers increase back up to baseline.
And as part of those findings, why has it seemed that the female dolphin population was affected more significantly than the male?
We speculate that the need to stay in acoustic contact with the calf is more important to females. Acoustics and acoustic contact among dolphins is preeminent in their lives. That's how they organize their societies. But with mothers and calves, that contact is essential for the survival of the calf. So it seems likely that the change in the acoustic environment associated with construction may have slowly but surely discouraged resident mothers to move to another part of their home range where it was less noisy. So the males didn't show a concurrent decline, but in subsequent time, we can show that the departure of the females disrupted the fabric of the society of the males considerably.
Sure. Yeah,
I would
think as one goes, so goes the other, I would think. Yeah,
absolutely.
With where you are now, and again, the study is still very much underway, is there an end point kind of projected for saying, okay, we did before, we did during, and we're sort of after? How long really is after slated to go?
Well, in my opinion, I think that long-term studies monitoring populations are essential because we can never tell when there could be an environmental perturbation that may be
You're gonna have
issue.
To define that.
An environmental difference.
Okay.
That something happens. So, for example, if we hadn't been monitoring the dolphins in Johns Pass, St. Petersburg, Florida, and the BP oil spill occurred, we wouldn't have any information on what was going on before that happened. And because we never know, but we need to stand prepared for the next big environmental hit, or even a minor one. The winter of 2009-2010 was the coldest winter on record. That had an impact on the fish and the dolphins. We need to know what is going on before things like that occur in order to measure their impact. So long-term monitoring, in my view, is essential.
And so with what you have found, if someone somewhere had a project that was going to be comparable to the construction thing at St. John's Pass, would there be some way that you could guide them that would have less environmental impact and therefore on dolphins or other wildlife because of what you've learned from conducting this study? Or are people inclined that are doing that kind of project to listen to such input?
I can't comment on whether they're willing to listen, but we have found a number of things that we could certainly introduce as potential suggestions. For example, in a coastal environment like St. Petersburg, the dolphins will spend their time in the shallow intercoastal waterways in the warm months, and they tend to go into the deeper waters of the Gulf in the cold months. If you want to start blowing things up on the shoreline, maybe you should do it during the cold months.
Okay, so that's a nuance that a lot of people that are planning a project like that would not think to factor in. So yeah,
we very much like to have practical application for what we're doing.
This is Talking Animals. I'm Duncan Schultz. My guest is Dr. Ann Weaver, an animal behaviorist who's been studying bottlenose dolphins for many years. Her new book is Secrets Behind the Dolphin's Smile, 25 Amazing Things Dolphins Do. And the lovely and talented Jeff Haynes is holding that up on Facebook Live for our stream. So we invite you to join the conversation by calling 813-239-9663, emailing dj@wmnf.org, or texting 813-433-0885. And yeah, as I alluded to, the interview is streaming on Facebook Live via my personal page. So again, if you're just joining us, if you go to Duncan Strauss on Facebook, you will see Dr. Weaver and me doing this very thing. So, all right. So there are really clearly practical considerations that do come from this that, again, like you say, whether they'll listen or not, that's out of our hands. But we have some very important things, just like the time of year or the season, how much difference that could make. So now, how is the study funded? Because it has been long-term, and you said earlier it's complicated. It's dolphins, they're underwater, and it takes probably a lot of resources. Well, how does that go, and has it changed the funding over any of these years?
I'll never tell.
Okay. Wow. Okay. Well, there you go. but was it NOAA originally, and is it still, are they involved in some capacity? Or
the research can't be conducted legally, and even access to dolphins at close range can't be conducted legally without a permit from NOAA.
Okay. So they've sanctioned it.
Absolutely.
But as far as the funding, you're tight-lipped for whatever reason.
I'll keep my secrets. I'll tell some of the secrets, as my book says, but not all.
Okay. All right. And speaking of that, when we spoke on the show a couple years ago or so, we did talk rather specifically, as we now have done, about the location of the study. But I noticed in the new book, again, Secrets Behind the Dolphin Smile, 25 Amazing Things Dolphins Do, you seem sort of disinclined to address the specifics of the location, you know, almost coy about it, as you repeatedly refer to the body of water where these dolphins live as the Enchanted River. Am I misinterpreting this, or do you indeed kind of shy away from spelling out where you're conducting the study or where these dolphins are living?
As per our previous consideration, there isn't any reason for me to increase the amount of boat traffic in the area.
Mm-hmm.
And I would like to be able to monitor dolphins in as, quote unquote, as natural an environment as possible.
Yeah. Okay. So it's just like, hey, why identify it specifically? This is going to bring more people out to say, hey, I'd like to see...
And there's another element to it too, Duncan. The Intracoastal Waterway is this enormous and fabulous system in the United States where vessels can travel parallel to the oceans without going into the open oceans. There's hundreds of miles of intracoastal waterway in just Florida. So the Enchanted River, with respect to the dolphin behavior, could be anywhere.
Right. Well, and also, part of the reason I asked this is because there were so many references to Enchanted River, and each time it was in quotes, and it just seemed like you were sort of being playful about it, but that you had a purpose as well, which you've kind of elaborated on here. So I should say, by the way, one of our emailers says, tell Ann Wendy Schultz, said hello and well done.
Thank you, Wendy.
Yeah. So let's talk a little bit more about the book. Actually, before we do, maybe you could just talk a little bit more about the specific methods, because this is field research, correct? And it's, I think, sort of what you do and over the sustained period and how you do it, to me, kind of echoes the way that Jane Goodall, Diane Fossey, Cynthia Moss, I mean, just lots of time with whatever animal they're studying, lots of note-taking, observing, photographing, and naming, right? But so talk a little bit about how, just like, today's not a great day to be out on the boat, even if you weren't here, but let's say that another day or two you go back on the boat. What happens for that stint? What would you be doing just on a random day of being back out on the Enchanted River?
On the Enchanted River. My study area is a specifically demarcated length of intracoastal waterway, and we monitor it the same way every time. So we leave from the same place, we go to the same northern end, we take the same route back, return to the same dock, and do it at the same time every day to the extent that the weather allows us to. We stop at all dolphins. And when we do that, then we take a variety of pieces of information. So one of the things that you can do when a dolphin surfaces to breathe, you should be able to name the exact behavior that they're showing when they do that. Now, they could be coming up vertically, like they're standing up like a person. It's called a spy hop. Mm-hmm. They could come up and lean to their side and look at you, and you call that a glance. They could lean to their side and not look at you, and you call that a lean. So you have a name for everything that every dolphin does when it comes to the surface. Because from the difference between studying dolphins in non-clear waters and almost every other animal is that you see them for a split second. So for example, if you're watching an ape nurse her baby, for example, they're never out of sight, or they can certainly travel, but the amount of time that dolphins are out of sight is a lot more. So you want to be able to grab as much information as you can. So I have written and illustrated a dictionary of dolphin behavior for this very purpose. It's got about 105 behaviors on it. And then we look at what the group is doing. Are they traveling from point A to point B? Socializing, which is my favorite subject, mm-hmm. Resting, or feeding? How many are there and who is there? So we can tell 374 dolphins apart as of this weekend.
Wow.
And that enables us to track the details of their social lives at a profound level of detail.
And is it one or more of their fins that helps distinguish one from the next 373, or how?
Yes. Okay. Yes, they have the fin on their back. It's called a dorsal fin. Yeah. And when they approach the surface or surface to breathe, you see that fin. And that's how we tell them apart.
Mm-hmm. But that, again, I guess over time, I mean, that seems like that'd be so precise. As you say, also, they're so fleeting that there's not much time to say, okay, that's Ralph or whatever swimming by. I mean, your dolphin names are much better than Ralph, I should say. But it just seems like, yeah, I guess like anything with that kind of experience and having developed your guide and dictionary and stuff, but it seems like it's so little to go on and sometimes for so fleeting.
But they do breathe regularly.
Yeah.
And they bring what they're doing back to the surface.
Yeah.
It takes about 2 years to get the standard dolphin used to being studied. And it takes a couple years to be able to identify them at sea in a split second. You have to do a lot of footwork first, taking photos and studying those photos back mm-hmm. at the lab.
I see.
And then at some point you start to be able to tell them apart. And that's when you can really get into the study of behavior.
Well, that might bring us then more directly to the book, because the book, I mean, I greatly enjoyed the book, and I was struck by how the dolphin world that you chronicle is, at least in part, marked by big themes. There's birth, there's illness, there's death, as well as somewhat smaller concerns, but still serious ones like courting rituals, bullying, even kidnapping in one case. You know, even reading just a few of these sagas, it's not hard to see how you spent so much time for so many years with these animals, because they're truly fascinating. So let's talk about a few of those stories. So I'm guessing one thing that may have particularly piqued some listeners' interest is the kidnapping case. Maybe you could describe a little bit what that really meant or what happened there.
That was an isolated incident in 13 years of concerted study. That's the only time we've seen anything remotely like that.
Yeah.
In which case, a newly pregnant female was moving around with a calf, and it took a while to decide that it wasn't her calf, and that the mother of the calf was following it. And then ultimately, there was a dramatic rescue in that story, one that you wouldn't have anticipated. But kidnapping is extremely rare.
Yeah, I mean, I was so struck by it. Yeah. Maybe you did mention the book. I didn't realize it was that rare, It's certainly part of the premise of the book is sort of unusual or striking things that you've kind of assembled that way. But I didn't realize it was that rare. So
along those lines, another profoundly and impressively rare behavior is harassment of the young. We've been out there 13 years. We've got 2,000 surveys, 14,000 groups of dolphins I've studied. 10 times only have we seen what appears to be rough behavior to a youngster, and it's not murderously rough, it's just rough. And in most of those cases, another dolphin intervened. But that's an impressive track record.
And almost equally impressive, as you described in some of those instances in the book, where when the other dolphins become aware that they, one or more of them, do seem to zoom right in and say, hey, this, we don't like what's going on here, and we're going to do whatever we can to get the young one away or to stop the bully or whatever the perpetrator is actually called in that case. But yeah, so that sense of protectiveness and community seems to really kick in.
You know, we've always heard about that in books.
Yeah.
But now that I've had the opportunity to see it and see what it looks like, because it isn't that obvious. You go out in a boat and you see one dolphin approach another. It isn't automatically a rescue nor automatically a problem.
Yeah.
But the way they actually go about intervening on behalf of one another is very impressive once you recognize how they do that.
And this may be also singular. Certainly, I think as you described it, it sounded like it was quite unusual. I don't know if it was as unusual as the kidnapping thing, but among the things that really stuck with me from the book was the dolphin who played dead, which I guess is a pretty unusual move, but the apparent strategy behind playing dead seemed to be like some sort of courtship or romantic strategy of some kind, or...
I will say that the dolphin that played dead, we will call him Drake for the book.
Okay.
He's a very interesting dolphin. He has a lot to say. He attempts to interact with the boat on a different level than a lot of the dolphins do. And that it did appear to be, his dying for attention move did appear to be a courtship maneuver. But bottlenose dolphins in my study area have a flair for showmanship. And a great many things that they do, in my view, are for each other, which is behavior that humans certainly recognize in themselves.
Yeah, interesting.
So in that case, he laid on his back for enough time to where we thought there was something medically wrong with him.
Yeah.
And then you'll have to read the story to see what happens.
Right, right. And along those lines, we're just in our last moment or two here. Is there one or maybe two stories out of the 25 that you think are just particularly representative? I mean, it sounds like the kidnapping is totally unusual and the playing dead as a courtship thing is pretty darn unusual. On the other hand, are there some that are very much representative of those bottlenose dolphins you've been studying for these 13 years?
I think the stories about the interactions between the males and females are fairly common. It was difficult to choose these particular 25 episodes because there's a lot of amazing things that they do. So in that case, I think it is the way they appear to influence each other socially that pertains to most of them. But these episodes are among the most striking we've seen, and that's why I chose them.
Yeah.
Because I don't think anyone's seen dolphins behave quite like this.
And so do other dolphin experts, have they come and spent time and or just consulted with you just about some of the things that, again, make up the book or just otherwise seem quite unusual and find it unusual in their realm of experience with dolphins, or...
There hasn't been a lot of discussion like that. No. Every researcher has their own primary goals.
Mm-hmm.
And in my case, social behavior is a primary interest of mine alongside the monitoring the population sizes and condition of the dolphins. But there is a new movement in the study of dolphins and whales along the lines that there may be differences across communities that constitute cultural differences. In other words, ways of doing things that are unique to a group that aren't necessarily directly associated with survival, for the same reason that they eat a certain kind of pizza in New York and a different kind of much better pizza in Chicago.
And that what you said there kind of raised another thought I had when I was reading this, is that to what extent is there, kind of like there are with orcas in certain areas, there's community orcas or resident orcas, I guess they're called, and then roaming orcas. To what extent is there a parallel in the bottlenose dolphin realm? Like the dolphins you've been studying are obviously there generally, those 374, for you to identify and study. But are there counterparts to them that are always on the go?
Yes, there's three layers. There's the resident dolphins. I would say about 45% of the animals we've identified are there most of the time. Then there's a second layer in which there's about 40% of the animals that aren't there most of the time, but they appear regularly. Kind of like Canadian tourists in St. Petersburg.
Okay,
they come every winter.
Yeah,
right,
okay.
Snowbirds,
yeah,
absolutely.
Okay.
And then there's a third layer. It's very transient, and you may see them once in 8 years.
Hmm. And is there anything that would suggest why one dolphin is in one of those three groups and another dolphin is in another? Is it just like a personality thing, just the way people eat one kind of pizza somewhere? And
well, in my view, the females tend to be a little bit more given to stay in an area because they usually have babies.
Raising their calves, yeah.
Raising their calves, and then the males will correspond to whatever phase she's in. So if she's actively raising a very young calf, the males don't pay a whole lot of attention.
Yeah.
But if it's been some time since she's had a young calf, the males are there to attend to her.
I see.
So I think their lives reverberate with the female.
Interesting. And a question that I think I started to ask when we were talking about the before, during, and after, and I think I may have gotten sidetracked, but I noticed one of our emails is asking a similar question. How much longer, the emailer says, will the study continue? So what is the after portion, or is it indeed going to be open-ended, or will there be a point where you feel like, okay, we really got enough now of data from the after portion of the before, during, and after to say this study has been completed?
I'd like to see it be open-ended.
Okay.
And that's because the impact of humanity on the natural world and certainly the coastlines never stops. So in the course of the major bridge construction project that initiated this study, there are two other less major bridge construction projects. Now, we're still impacting the natural world with too much noise, too much vessel activity, and changes in illumination associated with construction. So once we get such a solid baseline in an area, I think it behooves us to continue it.
And if you'd like to see that study continue, would I be right in thinking that you'd like to continue it as far as this baby will go?
I would love to spend the rest of my life studying these animals.
Yeah.
As I say in Secrets Behind the Dolphin Smile, they continue to reveal new things to us because I believe they trust us more. And this is one of the most intelligent species on Earth. What could be more powerful and persuasive reason to continue a study than the animals know and trust us now?
Well, it's also notable, too, because as I mentioned earlier, and if people... And is the book, by the way, chiefly available through Amazon, or are there other means to get it, just so people listening can...
The quickest way to get it is on Amazon.com, and it's either a paperback or a Kindle.
Like an e-book.
E-book.
Yeah, okay. Yeah, go ahead.
Duncan, can I ask you a question?
Sure,
go ahead. What was your favorite story in Secrets Behind the Dolphin Smile?
I kind of was really sort of struck by the kidnapping story, which is one of the things I asked about that, not knowing it was so incredibly rare. But I really kind of liked what to me at least seemed like the bullying story and how quickly, I guess there's kind of dolphins in that community that generally sort of stick up for others. But just the idea that they would zoom in and say, hey, this is not happening. And these young calves were sort of defensive or trying to get away, and they kept getting hurled up into the air or whatever was going on, at least one of those stories. I just thought there's a lot of cool things that I'd like to see more in our society. And I thought, wow, go dolphins. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, thanks. I appreciate that.
Yeah. So, all right. Well, we have just about reached the end of our time. We've been speaking with Dr. Ann Weaver. Again, her new book is Secrets Behind the Dolphin Smile, 25 Amazing Things Dolphins Do. Again, available through Amazon. either as an ebook or I guess a paperback if people prefer to read it that way. And we didn't even touch on that you have a whole other life as a statistician. And so, but I bring that partly because the website that has dolphin related stuff and statistic related stuff is goodnaturedstatistics.com. So Dr. Weaver, thanks so much for joining us today on Talking Animals.
Duncan, thank you so much for having me.
For sure. So in a few moments, I'll speak with Trevor Chin about that circus demonstration slated for Saturday. Right now, it's time to step into the Comedy Corner. We'll be hearing a piece from Kevin Hart, not only because he's a fledgling comic who could use a little exposure from Talking Animals, of course, but also because it extends today's dolphin theme. This is part of a piece called Phobias by Kevin Hart in today's Comedy Corner on Talking Animals.
I don't like dolphins. I'm scared of dolphins. I am. Me and my wife, we was in Maui. Right, we in Maui. She's like, come on, babe, we should go swim with the dolphins. I was like, nah, I told you how I feel about them dolphins. She's like, come on, stop being a bitch. Let's just do it. I was like, don't call me no bitch. She's like, bitch? Man, whatever. Like, you know, we don't got to come back, so you just got to, you stupid. That's all I had. I didn't have nothing else to say. So we go, we get there. They got the dolphins in this tank. It's like 8 dolphins in this tank, right? When I get there, I see this old lady on the back of a dolphin. I see this little boy. I'm like, you know what, babe? I might have been overreacting. Get the camera, take some pictures of me on the back of the dolphin. I was hyped, right? I get in the water. I'm on the back of the dolphin. The instructor, he was like, as soon as you grab the dolphin fin, the dolphin's gonna start taking you around. So whenever you're ready, grab his fin. I was like, all right, cool. I'm ready. As soon as I grabbed my dolphin fin, my dolphin went straight to the bottom of the tank. Like, he just went down. So because I was scared, I didn't let go. I held on. Like, you know when you're scared, how you start to mentally create in your own mind? I was like, okay, it's obvious that I got a racist dolphin. He don't like black people. He done cut a deal with a shark, bring him a black piece of meat. Something bad about to happen, right? So I let go, I get to the top. When I let go, I'm so scared, I start snapping on the instructor as soon as I see him. I was like, nobody saw dolphin number 8 missing? Y'all didn't notice I was going for like 30 seconds? He tried to kill me! He tried to kill me! I was mad, yo. I was fucking scared. I was like, y'all see the old lady and the little boy, but nobody saw the black swirl missing? Huh? Nobody noticed that the black dot wasn't going around? Y'all didn't notice that? He's like, calm down, man. Calm down. It's 3 feet. Just stand up. I was like, what? What'd he say? I didn't even realize that I was walking and talking shit. At the same time. Come to find out, I never even went underwater. What happened was, some water splashed in my face. And I panicked. I made it up. I made it all up. I was scared.
That was Kevin Hart with a portion of a piece called Phobias, taken from his CD, I'm a Grown Little Man. On to Trevor Chin to hear about the circus demonstration plan for Saturday. From Florida Voices for Animals, this is Trevor Chin on Talking Animals. Good morning, Trevor.
Good morning, Duncan.
Thanks for joining us on Talking Animals.
Well, thanks for inviting us.
Sure.
We'd like to let the public know that Florida Voices for Animals will be having a peaceful demonstration this Saturday in Riverview against the Showman Circus, and it'll be from noon to 1:15. That'll be, you know, just before their first show.
Sure. So let me back up, because what I was going to start actually with, Trevor, is just generally, I think at this point, listeners to the show should be pretty familiar with Florida Voices for Animals. But still, I thought it might be helpful if you could just give us a little capsule summary of what Florida Voices for Animals is and what it does.
Sure. Florida Voices for Animals is a local grassroots animal rights group in the Tampa Bay area. It had been formed way back in 1986 with a mother and daughter team. And so far, it's been growing over the years. I mean, right now, we have over 3,000 meetup members on our site. People can go to www.floridavoicesforanimals.org to be able to see what we're about. We have primarily two educational items. One is to educate the people about the abuses that animals go through and what they can do to help them. And the second prong is to promote veganism, because it is helpful for the animals, the environment, and the people themselves.
Great. Okay. Well, that's, I think, a really good capsule summary of Florida Voices for Animals and what it seeks to do. So now back to what's happening on Saturday. But I guess part of what I wanted to speak with you about this is that we're in that post-Ringling Brothers era where people think, okay, thankfully the circuses stopped, so all the elephants and other animals stopped touring around and going through all those horrible things that they went through for all those years on the road with Ringling. But what may not be as readily apparent at the same time is that there are still circuses and other entities, I guess, that still use elephants and or other animals. I can't say that I'm actually that familiar with Showman Circus. What can you tell me about that, Trevor?
Well, I think the Showman Circus, they normally just have a circus every year, and it's put on by this particular entity that they normally have some sort of events for entertainers, and this is just part of one of the events they put on at their center.
I see.
Every year.
So it's just on Saturday only, but as it sounds like from what you described, there's more than one performance.
Yeah, they've got three shows that day.
Okay.
And that's it.
And if someone is hearing this and says, oh, geez, I might have been one of those people who thought with the Ringling kind of folding up their tent, as it were, that there wasn't this kind of issue so much, if they just said, hey, you know what, I've got some time Saturday and I'd like to come out and maybe help with this demonstration, what would be a way? Are other people welcome to join the demonstration?
Yes, everyone is invited to join us at our peaceful demonstration. We'll have all of the signs available, so they don't have to make a sign.
Yeah.
Or they can bring their own customized sign if they'd like to. They can simply go to www.floridavoicesforanimals.org. Then you click on the meetup button that we've got there.
Mm-hmm.
Once they've joined the meetup, then they can look on the calendar for this particular demonstration and then RSVP.
Great. Well, it sounds simple enough. And if I'm not mistaken, by doing that same process, a number of other events of various kinds, whether it's protests or just getting together for a meal or whatever, also is presented on the meetup page. Is that correct?
Correct. On our meetup page, we've got lots of vegan buffets that are happening around the town. They can attend. We've also got many other special events. One of the events that we put on every year is the Tampa Bay Veg Fest, which is a free one-day event.
Sure.
In which we have speakers coming in talking about health issues, cooking demonstrations.
Yeah, we, of course, highlight it extensively on this show. So, yeah, it's a great sprawling event that has really built into something quite significant over the years. So, so Trevor, I'm afraid we're out of time at this point, but I thank you for joining us in Talking Animals. And again, I'm sure the demo will be quite successful. Again, maybe you'll get some other folks joining as a result of hearing this conversation. So thanks again for joining us on Talking Animals.
All right. Thank you, Duncan.
Thank you. Coming up at 11 on WNF, it's Rob Lori and Radioactivity, kicking off a three-hour block of interviews, phone calls, news, and more, including in the noon hour, Midpoint with Nola Lalay. Then at 1 p.m., John Gilmore presides over executive session. It's all coming up here on 88.5 WMNF. So we have just about reached the end of today's edition of Talking Animals. I'll be back next week when my guest will be Dr. Peter Rourke, the founder of Dog Is My Co-Pilot, which flies shelter animals having trouble finding homes in one part of the country to other parts of the country where they are in great demand and are placed in forever homes. So that's next Wednesday on Talking Animals. Meanwhile, please visit talkinganimals.net for audio archives of every show we've ever broadcast. iTunes podcasts are available there too. There's also links to our Facebook page, our Twitter feed, and more. Please like us on Facebook, the show, and or me personally, and follow me on Twitter. You can also subscribe to our e-newsletter to find out more about our guests a couple of days beforehand and other news from the Talking Animals world. I'm Duncan Strauss. Thanks very much for listening. Have a good week. Be kind to animals. Be kind to others. Be kind to yourself. This is Talking Animals on WMNF, Tampa, Brandon, Clearwater, Largo, Weekiwachee, and beyond, Community Conscious Radio, Handpicked Music and News. Thanks again for listening. Speaking again next Wednesday at 10 a.m. on Talking Animals. Rob Lori is up next with Radioactivity after 5 minutes of NPR News headlines coming up presently. Thanks.